who benefits, if anyone, from all this crisis talk?
From the crises which are promoted more, which are issues such as immigration, the benefit is to people who don't want you to be thinking about the biggest crisis. It's leading to young people being very fearful, of which the biggest impact is delaying having children themselves. So if we worry too much about everything, then this atmosphere we're in is actually part of the reason why we have such dramatically falling birth rates.
We live in anxious times, made more anxious by a public conversation in which almost everything is billed as a crisis. From the conditions of the NHS midwife service, AI killing off humanity, to Iran controlling the Straits of Hormuz. The word crisis was used twice as often in 1960 as it was in 1900, and since 1980, four times as much. So did the First and Second World Wars, the rise of communism, fascism, the threat of nuclear war not represent crises? Is the rising frequency of the appearance of the word crisis just an increase in hyperbole, a tendency driven by the media and now social media towards exaggeration and attention-seeking, or in a more affluent, essentially peaceful society, do writers, commentators, politicians, and dare I say it, podcasters, set an impossible utopian benchmark to judge any falling short a crisis? Well, to help us sift through this vast topic, it's great to be joined by Professor Danny Dorling, renowned for his research on social inequalities, health, housing, and demography, as well as his pioneering use of social data visualization and cartograms. He is a highly influential social geographer, statistician, and author, currently serving as the 1971 Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. His latest book, The Next Crisis, delivers an important and timely analysis on what the future looks like to most people. Examining global survey data on what worries our publics the most, he offers a deep analysis on what we should or should not call a crisis, what we can do about it, and Dorling's 10 commandments on the code by which we should live by. Professor Danny Dorling, great to have you on the show. Where to begin? I mean, you start off with 18 crises, I think, which you list, which we can all get worried about. And then there's this tremendous increase in the use of the word crisis. What induced you to write this, I think, really intriguing book? It's a kind of unexpected way to look at our times. I really liked it.
It was partly I was getting a bit tired of the overuse of the word crisis, so I thought I'd add to it. And my research career began in the late 80s, early 1990s, with funding from the Roundtree Foundation to look at the housing crisis. We've had a housing crisis for over 30, 40 years of a particular kind, with a remedy being suggested of build 300,000 houses a year, which doesn't change. But the number of crises has increased over time. You know, now we have climate crises. We didn't used to have them when I began my work. We have each new war is a particular crisis. You know, it's elevated. And I began to notice that there's a kind of growing degree of apathy amongst my students, the idea that it really was pretty awful, the world that they were in. And I think that's partly because they were being bombarded by these series of crises and having a sense that everything was getting worse. And this bombardment wasn't ordered. It was just, you know, what is today's crisis? You could click on the BBC News and find out, if you just click on the world news, what is the crisis today?
I know the Today programme at 8:10, the kind of lead, the lead interview is always about a crisis, you know.
Yeah, there was a point when the BBC has a website, and it began to actually have banners for the crises. So there would be a little banner where you could click on climate and find out what the latest for the climate crisis is. Cost of living appeared as a permanent menu item for the crisis. And of course, you know, the conflict in Gaza. I think they got to a point of having four of these menu options permanently on the BBC website before they realised there wasn't enough space to keep on adding more.
But you're not debunking the notion of crisis. You're just saying, let's get clear about what's a genuine crisis and what's should be relegated more down a list of priorities. And you've got some very interesting survey data also of actually what's going on around the world. It's quite interesting that that was not the same. I mean, I noticed that immigration is there, but well down the list, for example.
It's very low. I mean, this is Ipsos data that I use, which comes out monthly over 30 countries, including India, and there's separate data from a Chinese Academy of Social Science survey of China. Because I was interested in what do the majority of people view as the biggest crisis? And they're asked this question and asked it repeatedly. And the thing which most shocked me, actually made me quite ashamed, was seeing that the biggest crisis in the world, according to most of the people who are surveyed in these countries, now the second biggest, but it was the biggest 15 years ago, was fear of unemployment. And we don't tend to talk about that much, but it's the reality of, even if unemployment levels are low, the fear of not being wanted is latent in our societies. And I'm making it worse now because I'm mentioning a crisis you may not have thought about. but it's very instructive to see what people in general see of crises, and also what people paid to study crises see. I mean, people who are paid to study crises are endlessly worrying about computer viruses. But they, you know, and that's partly how you make your money, because you worry firms to say, you know, you could be taken over by a computer virus, which is possible. But actually, it's not the population's biggest fears, which are much more down to earth.
It's possible that artificial intelligence may be could go rogue on us and actually could eliminate the human race. And that's now being billed as an AI crisis, you know.
It's possible. We always have relatively some relatively temporary crises which kind of disappear. Killer bees was one, of the idea that bees were going to mutate and deadly bees would come up from Mexico to the United States. So there are these temporary crises. And I personally like to think of AI as something that we'll look back in 10 years' time and say, oh, that was so 2020s when they thought it was going to get rid of all these jobs. And, you know, everybody bought shares in the AI companies and then they lost out money.
I suspect that's right. I mean, there are menaces with AI. But as you say, it is kind of wearying to kind of be besieged by this kind of crisis talk. And as you say in the book, I mean, that there's a whole new industry of risk assessment. I mean, I sit on a number of boards of charities and other organisations. And there's always part of the board meeting is kind of the chair of the risk assessment committee gives you their assessment, sometimes commanding a lot of time, actually, on the risk assessment. And you do wonder, at the end of it, what's been achieved. All it does is make you all kind of a bit more worried than you would otherwise have been. Also worried that maybe the chair of the risk assessment committee and the committee may be undervaluing or over-assessing it. And yeah, but it's part of a kind of culture in which, you know, it's crises around us.
Yeah. Yeah. And the idea that we can control them, predict them. But also, I think, sadly, when you look at levels of anxiety, this, you know, world of constantly worrying about crises is actually creating a crisis of itself.
Go on, why don't you expand on that? That's the irony within the irony.
Well, I mean, and they differ, and people's perceptions of what the biggest crises are differ by social class and locations. But so amongst university students in Europe, it's the climate crisis, which is the biggest. Whereas amongst older adults, that ranks much lower and is falling. My personal fear of the crisis of crisis is it's leading to young people being very fearful and sometimes delaying doing things, of which the biggest impact is delaying having children themselves. So if we worry too much about everything and we think that the world is getting worse in many, many ways, or likely to, or there's a chance it could, then this atmosphere we're in is actually part of the reason why we have such dramatically falling birth rates. And then that will create a crisis of itself at some point. You know, if you work in universities now, anywhere in the world, your future is to halve in numbers within a generation or two in terms of the number of bums on seats. And it's not necessarily a problem if there are fewer people in the world in future, but if people are unable or feel unable to start families because their level of concern is so much that this year isn't the right time, let's wait till it's a better time, then there's a problem, because this year might actually not be as bad as you think.
The book does depend upon this view that we've made ourselves more anxious by subjecting ourselves to a flood of crises, or things we call crises, and that's making us depressed, changing our behaviours. And there's those stats I quoted in the introduction about how much more overused it is now as a term than it was in 1900. But maybe there are more crises, Danny. Maybe there are more crises around. I mean, climate change is a crisis. You know, the Straits of Hormuz is a crisis. Maybe there are more crises. I don't know. I mean,
well, we're better at identifying risk and things than we used to be. I mean, the only reason that, you know, the evidence was there earlier on about climate crisis, but it really has only been since the 1990s it's become unanimous, and that's our ability. But also, we have lived through a relatively peaceful period in terms of human history. You know, the proportion of deaths in wars is rising at the moment, but it is tiny compared to most of our history. Similarly, people may find this hard to believe, the rate of pandemics has been slowing dramatically for the last century. We used to have enormous numbers of epidemics and pandemics at an incredible rate.
I know, typhus, cholera, God knows where, yeah.
Yeah, diseases we couldn't do anything about, but also we had much larger flu pandemics, you know, in the past than we have now. I don't know why.
1919, the great flu epidemic after the First World War, for example.
Yeah, 50 million dead, you know. Oh, plus, that is an almighty crisis. And I think part of the reason why we elevate many things to the level of crisis now is because it's been a long time since a world war and a long time since a huge and sudden deadly pandemic. COVID-19 was much smaller.
So who benefits, if anyone, from all this crisis talk?
My view is that from the crises which are promoted more, which are issues such as immigration, the benefit is to people who don't want you to be thinking about the biggest crisis. So for those who don't want you to be worrying about inequality and cost of living, and who's eating all the pies, if you like, want you to worry about immigrants and that group. So it's when those crises which are over-promoted are the kind of clue. The folk who want you to worry about AI taking jobs don't want you to notice that we're actually maybe in a recession anyway, and we're not employing young people because firms don't have enough money or don't feel they have enough money to do it. And it's much easier to say, oh, it's AI, than it is to say, actually, you know, the first thing we cut is recruitment at the moment. But it's looking at the difference between what the public say are the things that they worry about most and other lists of crises. And you can see people trying to promote other things up then. And then you have to ask, what are the motives for this? And another big motive is clicking, is simply getting attention. So one problem is we used to have newspapers. We still do, but we used to have newspapers which were mainly print. Now we have newspapers which are online. You can measure how much every article is read, and journalists can get in trouble if their articles aren't read. So there's an incentive to write material that grabs the attention faster. And that is a worrying push towards ever more fear of crises.
What about the surveys? I mean, you mentioned already that unemployment's number two. What other things are out there?
Number one is inequality and poverty. And in recent years, added to that has been a cost of living crisis. And those two things separately both rank top. So I've merged them together and said they're the same thing. The cost of living crisis and inequality and poverty are the same worry. And it's not just about being poor. You know, now the idea of billionaires taking too much, multi-billionaires being greedy, is absolutely in the global conscious that it didn't used to be.
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organisation behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Cost of living and wealth inequality stroke poverty right at the top of the list. Then it's fear of unemployment. And then I was quite struck that actually immigration, which is such a big figure, such a big issue in Britain, is kind of 9th, 10th or 11th. And pandemics were quite low as well, actually. I mean, when I felt they should be higher. One of the points about your book is that we're not talking about, or the national conversation does not focus enough about what really are crises, instead of focusing on what may not be crises.
Yeah, it's all about looking at novelty. I mean, that's part of what news is that this is new. But for instance, you know, the third big one of violence, although the topical thing is war, the majority of people's fear of violence is actually local. It's of being mugged and being robbed. And that's still very high, particularly among women more than men. So a lot of this, when you look down at the data, mundane is the wrong word. These are people's real fears. But the kind of shock, horror, asteroid hitting us, you know, AI taking over, these are not in the minds or the lives of most people. It really is paying the weekly bill for a large majority of people. How are they going to do that? Their future or their kids' future, how safe are they? And then issues of local services. Will the hospitals work? Are the schools any good? Yeah, and these are the big ones. And it's not till you've gone past all of those do you get to people worrying about the climate. And the proportion of people worrying about the climate is generally falling. And it's higher in the UK than anywhere else in the world. You know, it's because it's seen as away in time and often far away in space.
To the extent the British do seem to care about it a lot, aren't we right? The extremes of temperature are there for us to see. The weather patterns, I mean, we're getting increasingly, you know, it kind of rains almost solidly from kind of mid-November to mid-March. And then we swelter in 40 degrees centigrade in the summer.
We're right that this is absolutely real and incredibly concerning. But there's a gap between incredibly concerning and 12 years to save the world. You know, that kind of level of... And the problem is, if you go to 12 years to save the world, you get people beginning to switch off. And that is what has occurred. I'd say the two biggest fears of climate change are, one, we have an inability to actually do something about it. It's the fear of our ability. And secondly, we will fail to adapt to what we need to adapt for the damage we've already done. So, you know, there are a lot of lands which are colder. The traditional human response to climate crisis that we had in the past was to move. But now we have great fears of people moving. Yeah, so it's really as much a fear about our ability to deal with what we've done and to change our behaviour so we do less pollution as it is about the thing itself.
Now, what are your three biggest concerns? Because having written this book, you know, you get to concluding chapters and you tell us, having held it back, so in a way I'm giving away... I'm giving the game away by actually getting you to disclose.
My biggest fear is, although it changed a bit, but now I put in, I am a child of the 70s and 80s, so nuclear war is still there for me.
That's number three on your list, isn't it? What's your other two?
My other two is about what affects my loved ones and people near me. And I probably put in illness. Did I put in illness or not? Yeah, to remind me, I haven't memorised.
You haven't memorised your own book, Danny. I mean, there was coronavirus and pandemics. You thought that the pandemic hadn't really gone away.
Oh, the long term effects of it. Yes, I've adjusted to this. Yeah, I mean, the pandemic obviously hasn't gone away. You know, it's recurring. The virus is with us again and again. And at the time I was writing the book a couple of years ago, this was worrying me quite a lot because it's not a good illness to get as you get older, particularly as a man. Men are 50% more likely to die from COVID. But no, in the last couple of years, I've come to accept that reality and it's now built in and it's no longer a worry. That's just the world we'll live in. And that is quite funny, I think, or quite, it's quite telling that I can't remember what I put as one of my biggest three fears.
That is the quality of a high-class interviewee, Danny Dorling. Having forgotten what's in your book, you turn it to your advantage.
Well, because this is my biggest fears, and they were my biggest fears at the time I was writing it. They alter. And what we worry about is really affected very much by our age, what's happening around us, our circumstances. We'll always have a worry, but it does change.
Now, you've got your Ten Commandments, and I was quite struck by these. I mean, there is an overlap with the kind of biblical Ten Commandments, but there's some different takes on them. Do you want to take us through them? And then I want to ask you about why you felt the need to kind of set it out.
They're the Ten Commandments of what was called a century ago the Socialist Sunday School Movement. What's interesting about this is, you know, at the time, this was, well, it was blasphemy. I mean, you know, setting up an alternative non-religious school on Sundays for children and then teaching them these terrible things. And they read to me, in a way, as so mundane. I'll give you them quickly. First of all, love your school fellows because they'll become your fellow workers and companions in life. That's like love your neighbour. Two, love learning, which is the food of the mind, and be grateful to your teachers as to your parents. Three, make every day holy by good and useful deeds and some kindly actions. Four, honour good people, be courteous and respect all, bow down to none. Now, you can see 100 years ago, the idea of bowing down to none would be fairly revolutionary and dangerous. Five, do not hate or offend anyone. Do not seek revenge, but stand up for your rights and resist tyranny. Six, be not cowardly, protect the feeble and love justice. Seven, remember that all good things of the earth are the result of labour. Whoever enjoys them without working for them is stealing the bread of the worker. That's a bit radical, but... Eight, observe and think in order to discover the truth. Do not believe what is contrary to reason and never deceive yourself or others. So very scientific. Nine, do not think that he who loves his country must hate and despise other nations or wish for war, which is a remnant of barbarism. Now, what's really sad about this is that these Ten Commandments appeared on the back of a banner which was being sewn in 1913 and has poppies on it. And ten, help bring about the day when all nations shall live fraternally together in peace and prosperity. So, put together just before the First World War, and the last two were how you need to avoid war between nations.
So, this was Danny Dorling kind of adopting and reminding us of the maxims of the Socialist Sunday School before the First World War. I liked it. I think it's a, you know, I mean, you might say they're unexceptional. I mean, it's useful. It's important to be reminded of these kind of maxims, you know?
They're really sensible. They're deeper than they appear. And at the time, these were radical. These were pretty radical statements by people at the forefront of trying to alter their societies. So one of the reasons I put the 10 statements into the book is that there will be movements happening now which will be seen as utterly fringe, suggesting we do certain things, which in 100 years' time, people will go, well, that's obvious. Of course you do it like that. and it's we're extremely bad at seeing that we do actually make progress. We think things never get better. War's always with us. Poverty's always with us. Whereas, in fact, in many ways, particularly in how we think, and the idea of bowing down to nobody, you know, that's a huge change. We really, I hope, nobody listening thinks that some people are their betters and others are they are above. You know, that's a big change. We don't think we should bow down to our betters anymore.
You began the interview, the podcast, by saying one of your objects in writing the book was that you wanted to make your students kind of less anxious, less depressed, less nihilistic. Do you think you've succeeded?
Maybe a little bit. In the book, I showed them, for instance, data on the number of people who die in what are called natural disasters, which are natural disasters affected by climate change. So floods and rockfalls caused by rain and hurricanes and so on. And way back in the 1950s, about 70 people for in every million every year died. In the 2020s so far, it's about one. It's gone down from 70 to one. Now, this isn't because we have far more natural disasters now, and they're worse because of climate change, but we're much better at dealing with them. This isn't an excuse for not worrying about them, but we warn people ahead. We evacuate them. We have ways of dealing. And that's an incredible degree of progress over time. So I try to point out things which are positive.
Is that your way of, as you round off this, fascinating discussion about crises? I mean, what's your message to our listeners about how to handle kind of this avalanche of crises that are coming towards them every day. Our media?
Try and put it in the context of what their grandparents, great-grandparents, or great-great-grandparents had to deal with. Often not their parents. You know, parents might have had a luckier time, depends where you're listening from. But it's great that we oppose war and say how terrible war is and try to stop wars. But many of our wars, in terms of number of deaths in wars, are smaller than they were in the past. So campaign and be worried, but try and put it into some perspective and some order.
There's one war, Danny, which is a kind of exception to that, which is Ukraine, where, you know, I mean, the deaths in Ukraine by Ukrainian servicemen and women now equaling the total number of deaths that the UK suffered during World War II.
But on the other hand, we were not actually invaded in World War II. But it's tricky because saying to worry less about something awful because it's not as awful as it might necessarily be is hard. We could do the same with genocides and put them in order, but then we get into real trouble. But it really matters whether you're talking millions or hundreds of thousands. Particularly in a human population now, which is much, much higher. You know, 8 billion of us, are we managing slightly better than previous generations to get along with each other, to feed each other, to get fatter and not starve as much as we used to? What about famines? And you can begin to list off, what about the chances of a baby living their first year of life? It's never been better in the world. Yeah, that. But quantitatively, there are lots of things which are getting better. And also, some of those things which are bad are often not as bad as they used to be.
Professor Dorling, Danny, we've known each other for a while, you and me. Great conversation. And congratulations on the book. It comes at today and the kind of circumstances of today in a very original way, in a very original framing. Thank you very much indeed for the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.